Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. On Tuesday, April 3rd, 1888, a series of brutal and vicious killings started happening in London and continued through November of 1891. During this time, a total of 10 murders of similar nature occurred within the East End neighborhoods of Whitechapel and Spitalfields, an area about 1 square mile. The victims were mostly middle-aged women, alcoholics, down-on-their-luck types. They were divorced, widowed, or unmarried, and supplemented any meager work they could find with prostitution, which was not considered a crime in those days. They were called unfortunates, which was another name to describe women who sold themselves for very little money or even a loaf of stale bread. It was suspected that their killer was approached by them as a possible client. Once he had them alone, he slashed their throats, then mutilated their bodies. Mostly, he attacked their breasts and pelvic area. The killer's hunting grounds were the gritty streets of the city's East End. However, with each new victim, the fear he generated spread to all of London, across Europe, and even to America. Soon after the murder started, the alleged killer wrote a letter in red ink to the Central News Agency. The letter was signed Jack the Ripper. And from there, a media sensation was born. London was gripped with fear and outrage. An emerging mass media, which we now know in modern day as the tabloids, fed into this fear with sensationalized coverage. Headlines such as, "How could this killer slaughter these women and escape in such crowded streets?" continued to stoke people's fears. As more victims turned up dead, the London papers mocked the police for their lack of progress. The frustrated public demanded the police do more to apprehend the predator. Even Queen Victoria expressed disappointment that the killer had not been caught. To this day, the killer's identity and these crimes remain one of the most infamous unsolved true crime mysteries of all time. His murders are the basis for hundreds of books, movies, and even true crime podcasts. Imagine that. So, what is the truth about Jack the Ripper? Though we will probably never be able to say for certain, I have my own theories on this case, and that is what we will be talking about today. As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what?
Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. I've interviewed lots of murderers, including serial killers. And the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. It's difficult to get a satisfying answer without diving deep into their mindsets. So that's what we're doing. And I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is the notorious Jack the Ripper. In 1888, London was the seat of Queen Victoria's vast British Empire. It was also a political, financial, and commercial powerhouse. Nearly 6 million people lived there, making it the largest capital city in the world. But London's prosperity was not shared by everyone. While the middle class was comfortable and the upper class led opulent lives, millions of poor Londoners were left in densely populated and squalid neighborhoods. Little concern was paid to their social welfare. When the Industrial Revolution brought about advances in farming, agricultural workers were displaced. Waves of unemployed English, Irish, Scottish, and Welsh people migrated to the capital looking for work. The pogroms of Tsarist Russia, coupled with crushing poverty, prompted tens of thousands of Jews to seek refuge in London as well. Most of these new arrivals piled into tenements in the east end of the city, which stood between slaughterhouses, sweatshops, warehouses, and pubs. There were few jobs to be had. With the abysmal living conditions, social tensions flared and ignited anger and suspicion toward the immigrants. Women and children suffered the most in the east end. Employment for women was limited to sweatshop tailoring, factory work, or unskilled labor. These were backbreaking jobs, 17 hours a day, and paid little. Widowed or divorced women were extremely vulnerable to hunger and homelessness, and out of desperation, many resorted to prostitution. In 1888, there were an estimated 60-plus brothels and 1,200 female sex workers in Whitechapel alone. So while women were accustomed to the day-to-day level of violence faced by sex workers, the brutality of the murders in the East End and the media attention they brought were a whole new experience. When people speak about serial killers, even novice true crime fans know the name Jack the Ripper. But for most, that is where their knowledge ends. There is a lot of confusion and folklore surrounding this killer. The complexities surrounding the case have led people to devote themselves to studying every detail of it, and they call themselves Ripperologists. One detail often debated is how many Whitechapel murders can truly be attributed to Jack the Ripper. Some popular legends have Jack killing all 10 women in the East End area at that time. but ripperologists believe he committed only five. These five murders, known as the Canonical Five, all occurred between August and November of 1888. However, there were two women murdered before the Canonical Five. Their deaths are included in the Ripper mythology because they were brutal, and they happened within 200 yards of the first canonical murder. One of the two women was killed on April 3, 1888. Brutally attacked, she died from a blood infection resulting from the multiple wounds to her body. The other victim was found 4 days later on August 7th. She was stabbed 39 times with a small blade. Neither murder was ever solved. About 3 weeks later, 43-year-old Marianne Nichols' mutilated body was found on Bucks Row in Whitechapel. Nichols is considered to be the first of the five canonical Jack the Ripper victims. She was last seen alive at 2:30 in the morning on August 31st, 1888. An hour later, two men came across Marianne lying on her back with her eyes open, her legs straight, her skirt raised up above her knees. Thinking she was just passed out, they reported their discovery to the police. When the police arrived on the scene, they immediately realized the victim's throat had been cut. The three officers present inspected the crime scene, but found no blood trails and no wagon wheel marks in the ground around her. This meant that she was killed where her body was found. They called a surgeon, the equivalent of a coroner back then, who determined she had only been dead about 30 minutes. The surgeon discovered both sides of Marianne's face were bruised by a fist or thumb before the killer slashed her throat twice. There was a deep, jagged wound about 2 inches long on her left side, and similar cuts were made on her right side. Her vaginal area was stabbed twice, and there were several incised wounds that ran across her abdomen. However, none of her organs were missing. The surgeon believed Marianne was facing her attacker when he held his hand over her mouth and cut her throat. Her death would have occurred in less than a minute. The remaining stab wounds probably took less than a minute to inflict. There was minimal blood spatter from those wounds because her heart had already stopped beating when he mutilated her body. Remember, the term mutilation refers to post-mortem activity, whereas the term torture refers to ante-mortem activity. The abdominal wounds ran left to right, prompting the surgeon to believe the killer was left-handed. He also theorized that the killer may have some knowledge of anatomy. I'd like to point out that his left-to-right theory is without merit because the killer could have used either hand. Right-handed people could easily use their right hand to swipe left to right. Police questioned all the residents in Bucks Row. Three men were seen nearby at the time of the murder, but they all claim they neither saw nor heard anything. The second canonical victim was 47-year-old Annie Chapman. A man found her body in the early hours of the morning. Her mutilated corpse lay in the yard of his residential building. Her body was found near the door next to the exterior steps. Her throat was slashed from left to right. But this victim? She had actually been eviscerated, meaning disemboweled. The police surgeon quickly established a link between this murder and Mary Ann's just 8 nights earlier. Both women had 2 deep cuts to their throats and their abdomens mutilated after their death. The morgue examination revealed that Chapman's intestines were pulled out and thrown over her right shoulder. Her protruding tongue and swollen face led the medical examiner to believe Chapman may have been asphyxiated with the handkerchief found around her neck before her throat was cut, and that her murderer had held her chin up as he performed this act. Her post-mortem mutilation was much worse than the previous victim. This means the killer was learning to do what he liked. There were neighbors who reported seeing and hearing things out of the ordinary that night. One witness reported Chapman speaking with a man earlier that same morning. He described him as taller than Annie, with a dark complexion, and wearing a dark coat and a deerstalker-type hat, like the kind worn by Sherlock Holmes. Local residents formed the Whitechapel Vigilante Community and offered a reward. They hired a private investigator, and they pressured police to do more to turn up leads on the killer. Public suspicion fell on the immigrants in the community, and anti-Semitism helped fuel those beliefs. Still, police came up empty-handed and made no arrest. On September 27th, a letter arrived at the Central News Agency mocking the police. It was written in red ink. The author declared his intention to cut the ear off of his next victim. Here's a portion of the letter he sent. "Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they looked so clever and talk about being on the right track. How can they catch me now? I love my work and I want to start again. Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work. Then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper." And then he wrote, "Don't mind me giving the trade name. Wasn't good enough to post this before I got all the red ink off my hands. Curse it, no luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now. Ha ha." Police did hold the letter for a few days before releasing it on October 1st to the public. Unfortunately, Jack had already claimed his next two victims. Sunday, September 30th, 1888, became known as the Night of the Double Events. Two women were found murdered within an hour of each other. Both women's throats had been slit. However, only one was dismembered after her death. The first body, discovered by a local cart driver, was still warm, leading police to theorize that the murderer was interrupted by the driver's arrival and fled the scene before he could mutilate his victim. If Jack was interrupted and did not have time to finish his ritual mutilation on his first victim that night, that would explain his need to target another woman so quickly. The second victim was savagely butchered, leading police to suspect the killer might be a trained butcher. The killer had also cut off a piece of the victim's apron and discarded it a few blocks away from the scene. But even with these clues, Jack eluded capture and allegedly continued to taunt police with postcards and letters. The last of the canonical five, 25-year-old Mary Jane Kelly, was the most gruesome murder. On November 9, 1888, police discovered Mary Jane's body in her apartment in the East End. Like the other four victims, her throat was slit, but pieces of her body were carefully placed about the room. The flesh from one of her legs was removed and delicately placed on the table next to her bed. Clearly, the killer was living out a fantasy. In addition to this carnage, the killer took the victim's heart. The over-the-top gore was probably due to the murder occurring indoors, which allowed the killer to take his time and not worry about being interrupted. It's important to remember the actual murder of these women happened very quickly when he slit their throat. I think he needed his victims dead and motionless so that he could carry out his fantasy of mutilation. This mutilation was the killer's ritual. In mutilating them, he was acting out a long-standing fantasy, and that was the reason he was killing these women to begin with. The medical examiner estimated the time of Mary Jane's death between 2 and 5:30 a.m. A photographer took pictures of the murder scene. These were some of the very first ever crime scene photographs. The City of London's police commissioner put half his police force in plain clothes to try and catch Jack the Ripper. Police investigators conducted an extensive investigation, going door to door, but no suspect was identified or charged. No other murders of similar nature occurred for 6 months, and the investigation wound down. Police and amateur sleuths have speculated that Jack the Ripper may have died or was incarcerated for a different crime. Maybe he was institutionalized or even emigrated. A few murders followed the next year, but less evidence exists to tie those murders to Jack the Ripper.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital on sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche.
The classrooms at the FBI Academy are far superior to anything I had experienced in college. About 60 seats in all. Every student had a ringside seat of the instructor and the crime scene photographs shown on the 6x6 foot screen behind the lecturer, John Douglas. Being a student in a profiling class in 1984 taught by the young John Douglas was kind of like having Elon Musk teach you how to build a rocket. John was one of the early founders of the modern-day Behavioral Assessment Unit, also known as the BAU. He authored the most well-known memoir about profiling, Mindhunter, which spawned the popular Netflix series by the same name. Part of the development of criminal personality profiling back then was interviewing 40 men who each committed at least 3 murders, and they did this for no reason other than their own pleasure. That work would become legendary long before John Douglas's retirement in 1995. Thanks to his book, the world became aware of the FBI's new technique of analyzing crime scenes and catching killers, and the public was fascinated. John Douglas was asked to do a criminal profile of the unknown killer called Jack the Ripper for British television. Here's a portion of what he came up with. Quote, all of the victims were prostitutes with a reputation for drinking heavily. These two factors place the victims in a high-risk category. By high risk, we define this as someone who is very likely to become the victim of violent crime. With a street-walking prostitute, the pool of possible suspects is vast. Jack's victims were targeted because they were readily accessible. He did not have to initiate the contact. It was done for him by the prostitute. This is an important feature in a case such as this and will be addressed later in this analysis under offender traits and characteristics. Primary areas that John Douglas noted in the analysis of Jack's crimes were 1. There was no evidence of sexual assault. 2. The subject killed the victim swiftly. 3. The subject was able to maintain control of his victims during the initial blitz style of attack. 4. The subject removed body parts. For example, a kidney, a vagina, a nose, on some of the victims. This indicated some knowledge of anatomy. 5. There was no evidence of physical torture prior to death. 6. There was post-mortem mutilation. 7. There was possible manual strangulation. 8. Rings were taken from one of the victims. 9. The last victim was killed indoors and was the most mutilated. The subject spent a considerable amount of time at that scene. 10. The time of death was in the early morning hours for all of the victims. 11. All homicides occurred within 1/4 mile from each other and occurred either on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday during early morning hours. The killer's modus operandi, also known as MO, was 1. The target selection, 2. The approach, and 3. The method of his initial attack. What takes place after is his ritual, also known as his signature. The ritual may become more elaborate with each homicide. Jack's last victim he killed inside and spent more time with her. The post-mortem mutilation was very important to him. It helped him carry out all of his fantasies. And his fantasy was to destroy a woman. Everything he did after the victim died was fantasy-driven. It was unique to him. It was his signature. Some communiques received by the police were allegedly from Jack the Ripper. John points out that, quote, it's quite rare when a serial murderer of this type communicates with police, media, or family. When they do communicate, they generally provide specifics relative to the crime that only the subject would know. They also usually reveal their motivation for committing such heinous acts. John does not believe the real killer communicated with anyone. It was John Douglas's opinion that this series of homicides were not perpetrated by someone who set up a challenge against law enforcement. He was not seeking notoriety. In other words, Douglas did not think that Jack the Ripper sent the letters and postcards to the newspapers. He believed that they were sent by an imposter and possibly news journalists trying to sell papers. These types of homicides are referred to as lust murders. Why? Simply because the genital areas of his victims were attacked. At the time John did this profile, he and the behavioral assessment unit had never experienced a female serial killer, either in research or in cases. It is for that reason that Jack the Ripper is referred to as a male. He was classified as Caucasian because Caucasians were the predominant race in the neighborhood, and the victims were also Caucasian. Generally, crimes like these are not interracial. They are intraracial. Regarding the offender's age, the onset for these types of homicides, lust killings, is generally mid to late 20s. However, based on the high degree of psychopathy exhibited at these crime scenes, meaning the mutilation, the ability of the subject to have an intelligent conversation with the victim until he could find a suitable location to kill her, as well as his ability to avoid detection, belies a maturity that places him in the age bracket of 28 to 36. According to Douglas, the unsub, or unknown subject, did not look out of the ordinary. But the clothing he wore during the assaults was not his everyday dress. He wanted to project to unsuspecting females that he had money. This relieved him from initiating contact. All he had to do was stand somewhere, and he would be approached by his next victim. Douglas's assessment went on to say that the killer was raised by a domineering mother and weak, passive, or even absent father. In all likelihood, his mother drank heavily and enjoyed the company of many men. As a result, he failed to receive consistent care and nurturing and contact with stable adult role models. As he grew up, he became detached socially, even antisocial, and preferred to be alone, while also developing a diminished emotional response toward others. As he grew up, his anger became internalized, and when he was young, he expressed his pent-up destructive emotions by setting fires and torturing small animals. Through these violent and destructive acts, the killer discovered increased feelings of power and control. He also learned how to perpetrate these crimes without detection or punishment. As he grew older and matured sexually, his fantasies developed a strong component that included domination, cruelty, and mutilation of women. One would expect to find evidence of this violent fantasy life through his personal writings, as well as his drawings of women being mutilated. Yes, it's not at all unusual for serial killers to draw pictures and write about their fantasies. Douglas thought that, for employment, This killer would seek a position where he could work alone and vicariously experience his destructive fantasies. Think butcher, mortician's helper, a medical examiner's assistant, or hospital attendant. He worked Monday through Friday and was free on weekends. He carried a knife for self-defense. Just in case he was ever attacked, he would be ready. This paranoid thinking developed because of his poor self-image. The profile goes on to say that the offender would have some type of physical abnormality, such as a speech impediment, a crippling injury, or a scarred complexion. The killer may be below or above average in height or weight. Profilers would not expect to see this type of offender to be married at the time of the murders. If he had been married, it would have been before the murders. And it would have been to someone older than himself. And if he had been married, it was short-lived. The reason it would have been an older woman was that this particular person would have been looking for a mother substitute. Remember, we believe that his own mother was horrible. Since he was not socially adept, the majority of his heterosexual relationships would be with prostitutes. Due to the lack of hygienic practices by prostitutes at that time and the absence of treatment for venereal diseases, he may have been infected. If he were, this would have further fueled his hatred and disgust for women. The offender would have been perceived by others as quiet, a loner, shy, slightly withdrawn, obedient, and he would have appeared neat and orderly in his appearance when he was working. Douglas believed that the killer drank in local pubs, and after a few drinks, he became more relaxed. He would then find it easier to engage in conversation and would also find it easier to do what he was about to do. Douglas believed that Jack the Ripper lived or worked in the Whitechapel area. The first homicide would be in close proximity to either his home or workplace. John noted that London Hospital was only one block from the first homicide, and it is likely he killed other women in that general vicinity, but they were not viewed as the work of Jack the Ripper. Investigators would most likely have interviewed him during the course of the investigation. Jack was probably talked to by police on several occasions about the murders. Unfortunately, at that time, there was no way to correlate that type of information. Investigators and citizens in the community had a preconceived idea of what Jack the Ripper would look like. Because of the belief that Jack would be very odd or ghoulish or look like a monster, the real killer was overlooked as a suspect. People at that time were looking for a shadowy figure, someone grotesque and repulsive that just screamed, "I'm the bad guy." They were not looking for a normal guy because they believed Jack the Ripper could not possibly be a normal-looking guy. Prior to each homicide, the offender was in a pub drinking, lowering his inhibitions. He did not specifically seek out a certain look in a woman. However, it was by no accident that he killed prostitutes. He had the sense to know when and where to attack his victims. There would have been many other women who approached Jack the Ripper and were not assaulted because the location was not secure enough. So what did he do after the murders? His post-offense behavior would include returning to an area where he could wash his hands of the blood and remove his clothing. Profilers would not expect him to inject himself into the police investigation or to provide bogus information. And as noted earlier, we do not believe that he would have engaged with the public through the newspapers. Jack the Ripper hunted every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for his victims. And when he could not find one, he returned to the locations where he had killed previous victims. Why? To relive the crime. If his victims were buried locally, he would visit the gravesites during the early morning hours for the purpose of reliving his lust murders. I can tell you, when police are told to surveil the gravesite, there have been times when the killer showed up. Jack the Ripper would not have committed suicide after the last homicide. Generally, in crimes such as these, the killer stops suddenly only because he came close to being identified, or he was interviewed by police in a way that frightened him, or he was arrested for some other type of offense. Would the profile you just heard have helped the police find the infamous Jack the Ripper? It would have definitely saved them some time in terms of looking in the right direction. And since it has now been over 100 years and the case is still unsolved, it definitely would not have hurt.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Many people, including famous crime writers, have speculated about who Jack the Ripper really was. Theories run the gamut from a local unskilled inhabitant from the slums of Whitechapel to a wealthy aristocrat from the upper crust section of London who traveled across town incognito to live out his maniacal fantasies of slashing and defiling women. Some speculation even pegged the unknown subject as a skilled surgeon. In 2014, some genetic researchers and armchair detectives claimed that they knew who the killer was based on DNA supposedly found on a silk shawl at the scene of the fourth murder in 1888. The so-called DNA evidence was acquired 120 years later at an auction in England. That's not exactly the most reliable chain of custody I've ever seen. A prestigious forensic journal actually published who they had identified as the real killer based on the shawl in question. But the evidence over 120 years could easily have been degraded or contaminated. So that account is not without its skeptics, and count me in that group. And that brings us to John Douglas's profile of the unknown subject that we previously discussed. John's profile was created in 1987 based on the killer's crime scenes, police reports, and medical examinations. Douglas's profile of Jack the Ripper is based on many things, and especially probabilities, likelihoods, and similarities of similar crimes studied by the FBI Behavioral Science Unit in the late 70s, early 80s, as well as their interviews of serial killers and lust killers. Since John Douglas created this profile in 1987, even more knowledge has been gleaned about how different types of killers act, how they choose their victims, how they live, and the best way to catch them. If the Ripper's crimes happened today, I think he'd be in handcuffs after the first two murders. Why do I say that? This killer was a sociopath. He was a disorganized person and therefore a disorganized killer. As such, he would likely leave a lot of evidence when he committed these murders. But lucky for him, forensics did not exist in 1888, let alone criminal profiling. Jack was careless and committed these murders at very high risk to himself, high risk of being caught. He killed four of his victims outside in a crowded area. True, it wasn't crowded at the time, but remember, one of his victims was found fairly shortly after she was murdered. His last victim's screams were heard by a neighbor located only one floor above her. All of this points to a man who lived in the area of the murders, had extremely poor impulse control, meaning he could not wait until it was safe for him to kill the woman, and he was free to roam about at night. This killer blended with the inhabitants of Whitechapel because he was one of them. He did not come from the upper crust halls of Windsor or Notting Hill to go for a walk on the wild side of the East End. Why do I say that? Because of Jack's frenzied style of attack, for one thing, as well as his lack of cunning in luring a victim to where it would have been safer for him to kill them. He did it right out in the street. All of that points to an uneducated man with poor verbal skills and poor impulse control. He was no doubt single at the time of the murders and probably never had a consenting, intimate relationship with anyone. This also explains why he did not kidnap his victims and take them to his home for a prolonged attack. Once he had the victim in close proximity, he could not wait to unleash his rage. He killed the majority of his victims right where he met them, on the street. Based on decades of research, we know about this kind of killer and how they kill. We can speculate forever about the identity of this killer and his MO. I'm certain that there is a large community of true crime fans that will continue to strive to uncover who this killer really was. But I have come to the only conclusion that I think I will ever truly believe about Jack the Ripper. He was an unhinged, woman-hating madman who, amazingly, did not get caught. This concludes Season 1 of Killer Psyche. Thank you all for listening. We will be back very soon with new episodes. Till then, stay safe. And remember what I always say, lock your doors. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review. Follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen 1 week early and ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Edited by Joshua Morales and Maxwell Carney, with research and editing assistance from Ann Liu. Our senior audio producer is Tom Monahan. Renee Levesque is production manager. And Haley Mandelberg is production coordinator. Brandon Clark and Lindsay Whistler are production assistants. And the line producer is Oscar Guida. Our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort and Marshall Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.